Welcome to Going Mental. This is your host, Eileen Kelly. I'm interested in the things many of us face but don't always talk about. After spending 5 months at McLean Hospital working on my mental health, I'm back. A little more insightful and with plenty of stories to share. Expanding on my usual topics of sexuality and intimacy, this season takes into account everything I learned during my stay. I'll be bringing together a wide range of guests, some beloved, some contentious, to discuss work, love, and the bizarre phenomenon that is modern life. Join me as we try to make sense of it all. On today's episode, I'm joined by P.E. Moskowitz, a journalist and writer who has written for publications such as the New York Times and the New Yorker. They also run a newsletter called Mental Health, spelled H-E-L-L-T-H, where they challenge popular pro-individualistic views on depression, diagnosis, and our emotional lives. Can you introduce yourself to start off?
Yeah, I'm P.E. Moskowitz. I'm a writer and journalist. I run Mental Health, which is a Substack on mental health, but more broadly, it's about how the world affects our brains and trying to get away from this idea that we are all chemically imbalanced and instead looking at the kind of material impacts that affect us in the world. And yeah, I write a lot about my own mental health. I've struggled with mental health throughout the years. And so it comes from a personal place, but trying to relate it to other people.
Yeah, and like the greater world, which we'll get more into. Right. Can you tell me a little bit about your upbringing and just like where you're from?
Sure. I was born and raised in New York City, in downtown Manhattan. Very hippie-ish parents. They were some of the first like artsy loft people, and went to public schools my whole life. And that really informed a lot of what I think about the world in terms of, you know, feeling like not sheltered by something like a private school, but feeling like, you know, people deserve equal access to everything, including things like mental health care. I moved away from New York for a while, but now I'm back because it's the only place I really feel is my home.
It's funny. All my friends who grew up in New York, I swear they always end up coming back.
Yeah. I always said like I could live anywhere, but I'll make sure I die in New York. And then I think after COVID hit, I was like, well, that could happen any minute.
So you're like, I gotta come back.
Yeah.
How did you first get started with your writing?
I, in college, was actually a photo student and was very like lost and confused about what I wanted to do. I was struggling a lot with my mental health, and I ended up getting this internship at like a tiny NPR station, NPR affiliate in Western Massachusetts. And this like gruff older journalism guy who ran the station basically took me under his wing, and like he was kind of like a father figure to me and like taught me the ropes of journalism. And so I just like fell in love with it. I fell in love with being able to talk to other people and pry into their lives and, you know, get to their deepest feelings about things. And both my parents are actually therapists, so it felt like a form of being a therapist, like not necessarily helping people, but like learning so much about people and their deepest desires and emotions and everything. So once I kind of got a taste of it, then that's all I wanted to do was, you know, be a writer and do journalism and write essays.
And when did you move into writing about mental health?
I've always written about it a little bit, like here and there. But 4 years ago, I basically had a mental breakdown after a near-death experience. I like almost died in the Charlottesville, you know, white supremacist terror attack. And
it's so horrible. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, thanks. And but that really obviously affected me, and I basically had like a mental breakdown that triggered a bunch of other stuff. And so that kind of gave me this firsthand experience of not only struggling more deeply with mental health than I ever had, but also all the different systems and methodologies and ways that people, you know, try to make themselves feel better. So, you know, from using drugs to using medications to going to therapy to doing acupuncture to all of these different things. And I started to become really interested in the ways we talk about mental health, because it felt like the kind of way I saw it being talked about online was so removed from my experience. Like, people just like love to diagnose themselves with things and say that they have a chemical imbalance and that's why they're this way. And to me, it was like, okay, but I have all these real world experiences that are making me feel this way. So if we just call it depression, or if we just call it anxiety, it feels like you're erasing what happened in my life. And so I started kind of getting obsessed with that idea of like how we individualize mental health, and started writing about it more. And then I also, you know, had around the same time I'd started transitioning, you know, taking hormones, and was just like fascinated by the interaction between that and my body and, you know, how it changed my positionality in life and everything. And I think it also just, you know, the more comfortable I became with myself, the more comfortable I became writing about myself and exploring my own brain on the page. So
that makes a lot of sense. And I'm also sure that the more comfortable you became with yourself, that translated through your writing to then probably also in a journalistic way, like people were more open to talking about these more intimate subjects.
Totally. I think what I do now is kind of like a journalism of emotions or something, like,
yeah.
Instead of like, write, because I used to write a lot more like traditional journalism, like about like cities and gentrification and all that stuff is really important to me still. But I feel like what I want to get out of journalism now is to like really understand how people work and how they, you know, what makes them tick and all of that.
Do you seek out like connection through writing about this stuff too?
Definitely. Yeah, I mean, I think I want to feel like I'm not alone. I think probably The hardest part of PTSD, the hardest part of like having a mental breakdown in general. And when I say mental breakdown, I mean, like I was gone, like I was like shaking, I was crying every day, I like thought I was dying, I thought I was going crazy. Like, and I think the hardest part of that beyond just like the direct symptoms is the feeling that no one knows what you're going through, which isn't true because a lot of people do know what you're going through, but the way our society is structured, you're kind of taught that like, you're the crazy one, that this is like an individual problem that is a very individual solution. So the more I write about these things, the more I'm like, oh, wow, everyone, not everyone, but most people I think are struggling in some form or another. And that we all do relate to each other in a variety of ways. And that's kind of like magical and beautiful to be able to be like, oh, you had a completely different life experience, but we're struggling with the same things. We have the same views on things. And yeah, so through my writing, I feel like I've really learned to not feel like I'm the only one going through stuff.
Yeah. I mean, it's such a, so fascinating to me. It's such a lived, shared experience of just being a human, like the things we go through. Obviously, it's really extreme, like we go through wars, but all the way to like everyone has at some point in their life has lost a family member, you right. know, people die and people are born, and it's just so mind-boggling that like a lot of this stuff is still not really talked about.
Yeah.
Like it's such a kind of taboo topic. And why do you think that is?
I think there is a very kind of purposeful suppression of talking about these kinds of things in, you know, many of the institutions we exist in work, in school, just taking work, for example, you know, if people really got together, you know, at a XYZ large corporation they work at and talked about how working there was really affecting their mental health and how maybe isolated they felt or overworked they felt, that would not be good for the bottom line of the company.
Yeah.
And I think the same is true, you know, even at a college, for example, where students really feel like they're paying all this money to like put themselves through like tremendous like emotional strain. They feel overworked. They feel so isolated from the real world, especially during like Zoom school or whatever. And, you know, so I think institutions have a vested interest in kind of not wanting people to talk about these things. Or if they do talk about them, to make them very individualized, like this is something you're going through and not something that everyone is going through. But I think we're also really scared to talk about this stuff because it would kind of force us to admit how bad the world is in a way. You know, it's kind of the same with like global warming or something, where we spent so many years in denial because just acknowledging that it was a real thing meant that we, you know, had to actually think about it, right? And mm-hmm. I think it's kind of the same with mental health too. If we realize like, oh my God, everyone is feeling depressed or anxious or has some kind of mental thing happening now, you know, regardless of who they are, what is going on in our world that's making people feel like this? I think that's a really scary revelation for people to have, to realize that it's not just a personal individual thing, but it's this thing that's happening at such a huge societal level.
Yeah. And kind of zooming out of the picture a little bit.
Right.
And I mean, I guess to put it simply, yeah, how do we accept the things we can't change?
Right. Good question.
No, but like even when you're mentioning like global warming, you know, like if global warming, for example, causes your anxiety and you obviously can't personally fix global warming,
right.
Will you ever be free of that anxiety? Or yeah, right. How do we fix this? It's like a more of a societal problem, which I know is a lot of what you focus your writing on.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I've kind of come to terms, I think a lot of what therapy has been useful for me actually is coming to terms with the fact that to a certain extent, I will always have bouts of depression and anxiety and everything, because I think I fought so hard against it for so long that, you know, that like I should be happy constantly. And, you know, the most helpful thing that my therapist has made me realize is like, life is hard and the world kind of sucks right now. It's okay to have to, you know, be sad and take a day off of work or whatever. It's okay to feel completely emotionally overwhelmed. And so, you know, I don't mean this in a nihilistic way, but I think we do just have to accept that in a world that has as many pressures as ours does, where people are working more and more hours for, you know, and have their rent increasing more and more and, you know, feel increasingly isolated from each other and all these things, that like, we should expect a level of depression and anxiety and other mental health issues, because, you know, if we didn't expect those things, we would be saying that none of these material things mattered, right? Like if we could all just be happy, even though the world increasingly sucked, then like, what's the point of fighting for anything, right? So I think we have to accept that, you know, depression, mental health is political. And the reason we feel these things is because of our surrounding political atmosphere.
And so can you just list off like a couple things that you feel like are causing mental health issues at like a greater rate in, you know, today's society?
A big one is just the lower pay that people are getting. You know, that pay has been flat since like the 60s, and yet rent has gone up, you know, 200%, or, you know, in some places 500%. And how that forces you to live a life that doesn't provide for the time and space to take a breather, to have community, to have vacation, to
enjoy your life a little bit.
Right, exactly. I mean, you know, I live in New York City. In some ways, I'm privileged to be able to be a freelancer and make my own schedule and whatever. But, you know, I still have to work all the time. All my friends are working all the time. The kind of things that bring joy in life have been pushed to the back burner because of how much everyone has to work. So I think that's a big one. And then I think relatedly, the kind of isolation that's caused by a lot of the ways we work and socialize now, you know, like, I feel like it's trendy now to push back on the idea that the internet is bad for us or social media is bad for us because people don't want to admit that it is. But I really think it is. I really think that it's causing a lot of disconnection, and a kind of disconnection of the self, where we feel like we have a real self and a presented online. Yeah. And if we can't live up to that online self, then we feel really bad. And also, I think the flattening of the world that social media causes. I talked to this like Buddhist psychotherapist. He actually wrote a piece for Mental Health, the newsletter. And he was saying that, you know, before, the idea of keeping up with the Joneses, right, was like, if your neighbor has like a dishwasher, then you want a dishwasher. But now keeping up with the Joneses is you follow 1,000 Instagram influencers, and if you don't have a life as perfect as theirs, then you're confused as to why, and you feel, you know, self-conscious and everything. So,
and can split your identity. I actually just had a psychiatrist on the podcast, and she talked about, she's a mother, really having to explain to her kids that what people put on Instagram specifically is their highlight reel. It's like the highlight of their life. Like you have to remove yourself from it and realize like, okay, they're not putting like, you know, the night they stay home and they're crying over, I don't know, the day that they're sick from food poisoning, or the day they're breaking out, or they have body dysmorphic, you know, issues. And I remember, and I'm old enough to remember like pre-Instagram. Mm-hmm. Like I think Instagram came out when I was like middle of high school. So like obviously I was there for like Facebook and stuff, but I worry about younger generations where they don't have that ability to differentiate between like before and now.
Totally. I think we're seeing that. There was just a story that came out that, you know, Facebook did this internal study that was basically like Instagram. It showed, you know, their own corporate study showed that Instagram was like terrible for teenagers' mental health, that especially for teenage girls, that it was like causing anorexia, that it was causing suicidal thoughts and all of this stuff. And then Facebook,
it's like every 7 seconds, I think, a teenage girl has a negative thought pattern when they're on social media or something insane. I read the other day.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely hard for kids, you know, growing up now, but I do have a little bit of hope that, because they've been so inundated by it, they have kind of pushed back. And I've even noticed this like in my own family, you know, at a family reunion where it's more people my age who feel tethered to their phone. And I think young people, because they grew up with it, can be like, I don't want this anymore.
Yeah.
And have kind of pushed back against it. So,
but don't you think it's more inundated in our lives? Like it's harder and harder to not have it.
Yes,
like,
totally.
Like especially as a freelancer, like for me having a podcast, like I literally have to use social media to like get the word out about what I'm like working on.
Right. And I think this is why we have to think of it more systemically than we do. Like right now we think of it as like an addiction, which I think is the completely wrong model to think about social media. I wrote this piece a few weeks ago that was basically like, we should think of the internet as a factory that, you know, produces value, you know, through our social media labor. So like Facebook and Instagram and Twitter are all making money based on us making content. It's almost like we're creating a TV show that we're not getting paid for or something, right? Especially TikTok. When I see how much effort goes into making a TikTok, I'm like, you just gave like 4 hours of your life and you're not being paid for it or anything, right?
I know, but I guess if you go viral, then like that's the goal sometimes, because then you can get paid the big bucks for it.
Right, right. So now we're not even working for money. We're working for the chance to maybe get money if we go viral enough.
No, exactly. It's a scary concept.
Yeah. I think that's how we have to start thinking of social media, is like, this is a place of a site of labor, a site of us putting work in, and we can't just break this cycle individually, because in 1805, if someone was like working in a shoemaking factory, you wouldn't just be like, stop being so addicted to making shoes, you know, like they're doing it because they have to be there. So I think we have to view social media in the same way, that we kind of all have to be there, and we all have to have a kind of collective solution to this problem.
I agree. But the one thing I will say in terms of looking at it as more of an addiction than, let's say, making shoes, is that, you know, there have been studies that even just getting a like on your photo or a comment releases dopamine. Right. And it is this external validation that I feel like isn't the same as someone in a shoe factory.
Totally. I think that is a huge difference. And so in a way, if you think about it, the payment form of our labor is now dopamine instead of money. So I think that does cause a kind of addiction to it. But I also think that there is a comparison in work and labor. Like if you were going back to the, you know, proverbial shoemaker man that I made up in my head. You know, you through your work, you get community. Through your work, you join a union. Through your work, you find other people who you want to go to dinner with or join a church with or whatever, right? So the site of our labor is also very intimately linked with like the site of everything else in our life. But I do think you're right. I do think it's different. Like, they're purposely making it so that our brains are dependent on these things.
Yeah, and our attention spans are getting smaller and smaller. I remember I read an article years ago that was like the attention span of the average teenager and like the amount of hours they spend online right now is like that of a goldfish.
Wow. Yeah. No, it's bad for us. And, you know, I think we have to place blame where it belongs, which is not like the abstract idea of the internet, but at these corporations that, you know, they literally hire psychologists to make it as addictive as possible, right?
Yeah, or that our government, like, why isn't there an age restriction? Like, I know there is like technically one on Instagram, but do they really enforce it? No.
Right. No. And yeah, or why isn't our government studying these things? Why isn't our government proposing solutions? So I think it should be more of a site of political struggle, though, like that we should be organizing around these things. Like, if you ask anyone, everyone is miserable online, right? The first thing anyone says when you ask about Twitter or Instagram is they go like, ugh, I hate Twitter, I hate Instagram, right? And then they spend 5 hours on it a day. So why aren't we collectively talking about this as a huge problem that it is, you know?
Yeah, I want to talk about that Instagram, Facebook, WhatsApp blackout that happened. Mm. So for anyone listening, because I know this will probably come out in like a couple weeks, we're recording this like a couple days after the largest internet blackout on Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp since like 2008 is what I read. Mm-hmm. How did that day go for you?
I don't use Instagram or Facebook much. I use Twitter a lot too much. I want to get off of it completely, but my job, much like yours, is tied to being on social media.
Yeah.
But so it didn't affect me a lot, but it did make me kind of really scared because these companies have essentially become like communication infrastructure at this point, like especially Facebook with WhatsApp. You know, the rest of the world, it's not as popular in the US, but the rest of the world, like WhatsApp is synonymous with texting essentially. So the idea that just because a corporation did something stupid, like I think they literally like
deleted some code or something.
Yeah,
on
and then they had to like take an axe to their server farm and like break in manually. and
I read that it actually got deleted. That was the problem. That's why it took 5 hours to get it back up and running, as they had to like rebuild it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, and I'm not a tech wizard, but it definitely sounded like a series of massive screw ups. But the idea that a company can be so large that can impact the entire world
when
that
happens. The entire world in 5 hours.
Right. That is very scary to me. I mean, and there's no reason to me that we shouldn't break up Facebook as a monopoly, because it is a monopoly. But
yeah, it was estimated that businesses around the world lost like hundreds of millions of dollars in those 5 hours. And what's his face? I can't believe I'm forgetting this. Who started Facebook? I'm
Mark
so
Zuckerberg.
Embarrassed. Mark Zuckerberg. Maybe I'm blocking it out. He lost $7 billion in 5 hours of Facebook stock or something insane.
Yeah.
That like just the whole world could tank, it seems, if that didn't come back.
Right.
Which is like, why does this one company have so much control? Exactly what you're saying. No, it's terrifying.
Yeah, I mean, nothing.
I'm like,
have
that's
that
a Black
power.
Mirror episode, is like all that stuff goes down and it doesn't come back. And then like the world is scrambling.
Right. And yeah, I mean, nothing should have that much power, period. I don't think.
Yeah, and especially something that we don't like vote for or have any say on.
Right, exactly.
Okay, I want to talk a little bit about your experience in a little more in depth in Charlottesville, if that's okay.
Yeah.
And then also when I was prepping for this interview, I read about your experience with 9/11 and growing up in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, just to get like a deeper understanding of kind of what seems to have kind of started your work in the mental health space or your own mental health struggles.
So yeah, when I was 13, I was in middle school, two blocks away from the Twin Towers. And, you know, to give a very brief overview, like felt the building shake, my binder dropped on the floor. I left the school with like 10 or so friends and one of their moms who lived close by because she was convinced that one of the buildings would collapse. And everyone was like, why would that happen? That's not going to happen. Anyway, she was proven right. So we had to like run from the first debris. Collapsing tower. Yeah. Saw lots of blood and death. And yeah, that was not a good day. but I was 13 and didn't really know how to process it at all. But I think two things happened on that day. One, I think that's kind of like the start of, you know, what would become a growing mental health problem for me, just in terms of when something that big happens to you when you're so young, there's just no way to process it. So I think that kind of creates two versions of your brain, one where you can kind of ignore where that happened and one where you can live your daily life, or where you can just like keep it in a box, right? And so I think that really started this process that I've been taking many years to work through now in therapy of splitting myself into kind of two, you know, like the me who can survive on a daily basis and then the emotional self. Mm-hmm. And so, but because I had to close off so much from that experience, I think I closed off all my emotions. Like I would cry once every like 5 years until recently. Wow. And I thought I was like normal. I mean, for a while I was living like a kind of normal, happy-ish life. It's not like I felt like, don't think about that, but I was just so cut off emotionally. And then when Charlottesville happened, I was down there reporting. It was, you know, it felt great to be like, I was kind of reporting, but also kind of part of the counter protesters. And it felt great it felt like we had like kicked the Nazis out of town and we had won. And it felt like this amazing, ecstatic collective moment of like the, you know, the world is ours and we can do whatever we want. And like, you know, yeah, racists are terrible and we're getting them out and we're doing something good. And then this terrible thing happened where like, you know, I had to run for my life and I was with two friends and I couldn't find them. And I, you know, had blood on my legs from people being hit by the car and really, really awful. But my response was essentially just, again, to shut it down, you know? I think I learned that from 9/11 was just turn off that part of my brain. And I was like, okay, well, I survived, so everything's fine, you know?
Do you feel like it re-triggered almost?
Well, not at that moment, but then a month later, I was flying to San Francisco to give like a talk about something totally unrelated. And I started feeling like really weird. And then the next morning in the hotel room alone and like across the country from my family and friends, like woke up and was literally shaking. And like, it felt like everything had just shifted 90 degrees somehow. Like it felt like shadows were kind of like lurking behind every corner. And it felt like, you know, like I couldn't eat food because I was like so terrified. The best way I can describe it is, you know, if you like trip and fall, that second where you know you're about to hit the ground, like the amount of adrenaline you have there, if it felt like that, but like 24 hours a day. And so I didn't feel like I was losing my mind. I lost my mind. I think everything I had blocked out, I think Charlottesville kind of triggered the opening of it, but out came all this other stuff too, 9/11 and gender stuff and everything else. But so that was, I mean, it's been like 4 years of being in therapy and trying various medications and other drugs that we can talk about if you want.
I do want to get into that to kind of piece it together.
Yeah. So for the first, I would say like 6 months, I was at points convinced that like I could not make it, that if I had to go through another 6 months of that, you know, I would end up harming myself. So, but it slowly got better and like, will forever be grateful to my therapist and a lot of other people who supported me. But that was what really got me thinking about like mental health and how we conceptualize it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing and being so open.
Yeah.
Do you feel like when 9/11 happened, so you were in middle school, was there a lot of support at your school? Because I'm guessing, I mean, that was a shared experience with people who were in your classroom or your school.
Kind of, not really. I think you had the option to like speak to a guidance counselor a few times or something.
But maybe just everyone was in such a shock, like our whole country, the whole world.
Right. And that was also the hard part, was that like it immediately became politicized. Like we as kids had experienced this trauma, but then all of a sudden it was like the governor and the president being like, this is our trauma to share. And we were like, no, it's not.
Like, yeah,
we were there. Yeah. And like, you know, like wars being started in our names, and you know, like then thankfully I didn't know anyone who died, but like, you know, the kids whose parents died to have your parents used as kind of an excuse for, you know, to invade Iraq or whatever. Like, it felt like it was kind of that experience was robbed from us through its politicization. And I think that made me cynical in a way, like at a very young age, like that, you know, the world is just like really messed up and politics is a sham and all of that. But it also made me much more curious about the world too. I'm not saying there was a silver lining. There was no silver lining, but I do feel like it kind of burst this bubble that I was in as like a, you know, young white kid who had never experienced that much bad stuff happening, where I was like, oh, like the world is not this safe cocoon. The world is much different than I thought it was.
Yeah. And you talked about kind of stuffing your emotions away and being repressed for many years. Mm-hmm. And I personally really relate to that. So I lost my mom when I was young. I was 8 years old, and it was a very sudden kind of traumatic death. And for many, many years, up until honestly like my 20s, I felt very emotionally removed, yeah, almost like dissociated in a way. Just like, and that was as a child, similar to what you explained with 9/11. Like, that's how I dealt with the trauma.
Right.
Just like, don't think about it. But I wasn't telling myself to actively not think about it. I just didn't. I'm wondering when you feel like it was after Charlottesville that you started to come out of that, or it's more recent?
Yeah, I mean, I think Charlottesville, I think it's like my brain had a cup of some kind that held, or a box or whatever, that held all my trauma and all this stuff I was repressing. And then Charlottesville just like added a boulder on top of that cup or whatever. So it's like the cup just shattered. Right. And like all the shrapnel of the cup or whatever, I don't know, this is probably a bad metaphor, like, you know, hit other pieces of my brain and everything was scrambled or whatever. So I think Charlottesville was just like this event, I guess the straw that broke the camel's back, would be a better metaphor maybe, but,
No, I think they're both good. You're good at creating imagery. I think it's nice specifically for listening to a podcast.
Oh, thanks. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, the brain, I can only think of it through sometimes I joke with my therapist. I'm like, sorry for saying like five bad metaphors in a row. And he's like, it's okay. Like, that's what I'm here for. Yeah, I think that really forced me to realize that I couldn't just like get on with my life. I had to actually feel the feelings that I had never felt. And I was, that made me so angry, because I was just like, I felt so incapacitated. Like, I think I'm still a workaholic, but then I was much more of a workaholic. And I like couldn't get back to writing. And I felt like if I couldn't write, then I might as well be dead. And like, I just felt so angry that I felt so incapacitated. And, you know, my therapist, my parents, lots of people were just like, it's okay to like need, like you almost died. Like, it's okay to need time to recover, you know? And that's still something that's kind of hard for me to accept in a lot of ways. It's like, I want to be able to just do the things I want. I want to be able to write and, you know, whatever, do anything I want in the world, and to feel like so affected by the world and so impacted is still really hard for me, because I think I would rather pretend I'm invincible for some reason. Yeah. And I guess another thing I should mention is that like, it wasn't easy in retrospect to do all that repression. When I look back at high school, you know, like the year after 9/11, I started doing drugs really early, and like,
okay.
I'm not anti-drug. I still do drugs and I think they can be really helpful, but the way I was doing drugs was not a helpful way, right? I was doing way too much like cocaine, and I got an Adderall prescription from a shady
psychiatrist
who like prescribed me like an insane amount of amphetamines. And I was like staying up for days at a time, you know, like I was without realizing it, I was like spiraling. Like kind of functional, but the repression took a lot of work, and I needed to use a lot of tools like drugs in order to keep it going.
I feel like so many people live their lives though in that state.
Totally. And that's something I've realized is like, I think we all have that cup or whatever that holds our traumas, right? And I think to a certain extent that's inevitable and required for functioning. Like you can't just be crying all the time every single day if you want to like hold down a job or something, right? So I think everyone has that cup, but for people who maybe don't have as much trauma, or for whatever reason don't have the kind of thing that breaks that cup open, that they can kind of just live in that permanent state, right? And for some people that does require lots of drugs or, you know, other forms of self-harm that, you know, keeps them in this removed state. But I think for a lot of people, I mean, I think if the cup never breaks or overflows or whatever, then you can just kind of go on through life without realizing that you've been affected by many things.
I know, but I wonder if you continue your life that way and are living almost this dissociated kind of straight and narrow, I'm not really even allowing myself to feel the things I should be feeling or want to feel. I don't know. To me, that seems like kind of a sad life.
Yeah.
I just feel like a lot of people also get wrapped up just even in the workflow of things. Like so many people I know in New York, for example, who are like, yeah, working these crazy 9-to-5s, and you're just like so wrapped up in the day to day that, yeah, you're like numbed out to maybe having really genuine connections or like going for that partner that maybe you would have an awesome romance with. And like, you're missing out on the things that make life meaningful.
Right. I think that's true. I mean, and something I think a lot about now is like, now that cup has broken in my brain, my life is, I think, harder than it was before my mental breakdown, but it's also much more fulfilling and
richer.
I feel more lows. I feel more emotions of all kind, but that also means that I can like feel true bliss and like true excitement and, you know, feel like it's like, I feel like this sounds so corny, but it feels like I like understand art now.
No, you know, like, I really relate to everything you're saying. It's like you almost have to feel those lows or accept feeling those lows to even know what happiness is, or like what the highs and the good parts of life. If life is only great or it's only stable and mundane, like,
right,
then you have nothing to compare it to.
Right. And I also think it requires a kind of dissociation to not feel the lows that, you know, as you were saying, like a lot of people kind of make that compromise, like not consciously necessarily, but I think a lot of people, their main mission in life is to not feel those emotions that are really hard to feel. Right. I think we're really taught to do that. I mean, in the military, they purposefully like kind of, they do like a desensitization training, right? Where they like push people through these really hard experiences, because part of what, you know, going through things like boot camp does is make you feel desensitized so that you always feel a little bit dehumanized and therefore can do more bad things.
Yeah. Crazy things like kill people and not be affected by it.
Right. And so I think, you know, even though we're not all in the military, I think living in this society, we're all kind of going through that same training in a way where we learn to become desensitized. And that way we kind of turn off a part of our brain that I think we're scared to have on, which is that, you know, this like, oh shit moment of like, oh my God, so many people are struggling. So many people are going through really horrible things. I'm not satisfied with my life. I have missed out on all these things that I want to do. It's much easier to just have that turned off. And I think a lot of people go through life feeling like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What are some tangible ways you think as a society or we could counteract that?
Well, this is not to plug my own stuff, but this is the book I'm hopefully going to start writing soon.
No, I mean, use it to plug yourself. That's like a point. Go on.
Yeah. I'm currently, my agent has the book proposal and we'll see. I don't want to give too much away, but basically like I've become obsessed with this idea of like rabbit holes. Like I feel like what I went through in the last 4 years was a rabbit hole where like I came out on the other side and the world was different, brighter colors. And, you know, like it was a very trippy experience in a way. And part of the reason it was trippy is because I used a lot of hallucinogens. but I think it was just trippy in general to like come to a completely different perspective on life, which I don't think requires drugs. I think we can have like our own kind of rabbit holes and weird experiences in our brain without drugs too. But microdosing LSD for me really helped almost cure my depression, honestly. But it also, I think the reason it worked, and I've written a lot about this, about LSD and ketamine and other drugs, like the reason it worked is because it kind of allows you to see your brain from a bird's eye view, and you can kind of connect things together that you couldn't when you're stuck in this cycle. So I think that's one way to do it. But I also think things like, I know this sounds maybe like obvious or something, but I think like really finding like spiritual practices or like, you know, things like yoga or acupuncture, things like that, they allow us to actually feel at home in our bodies and feel connected to ourselves in this way that I think we spend a lot of time not feeling. Even having like really good sex, I think, is a good way to do this. Like these experiences that make you realize like what pleasure actually is. And then mm-hmm. I think once you realize the height of emotion that you can get to, you know, either through some kind of like enlightenment through yoga or whatever, or through something like really good sex, right? Then you kind of start wondering like, hey, why am I not experiencing this in the rest of my life or as much as I want to, right? And I don't know if you've seen this like chart that is always going around the internet, but like people are having so much less sex now than they did 20, 30 years ago. And I don't think that's a coincidence. Like, as I was saying, it's easier to spend your life disconnected a little bit than to realize what you're missing, right? Or what you don't want to go through emotionally. And so I think like that's kind of a sign of that, that people rather kind of shut themselves down sexually or like not experience all the joys of life than realize all the joys they're missing.
Yeah, I agree. I also think social media and just like living on our phones has a lot to do right. with that as well. Like just having these connections through the phone, which ultimately is like a much more subdued connection than right. even like a phone call or like seeing someone in person.
Totally. And like we've learned to kind of live with less in this way, right? Where socializing through your phone isn't the same as having an orgasmic experience. I'm not like a sex therapist or something. I don't, you know, like I'm not like obsessed with this as a topic, but I just think it's a good example. Like, you know, it's the kind of two extremes, like tweeting versus like, you know, sleeping with someone, right? They're both kind of on the same spectrum of socializing. And we've learned to live with the least possible one, the one where we feel just enough dopamine and just enough oxytocin or whatever to like get through the day, right?
Without actually having to like, well, it seems almost like, yeah, without having to like really do the work of seeing someone or
right.
the anxiety. So it's right. like, yeah, if you're listening to this, you know, make that phone call, go make exactly. a plan to like go see your friend tonight or later today and like do something, like go for a walk, leave your phone at home this weekend, even just for like an hour. Like those are really important. Like I even have to remind myself, almost like reprogramming my brain, like, okay, I'm going to go get my nails done. Like, I don't need to bring my phone right. where I'm just going to play on my phone for an hour. Like, right. I'm going to bring a book right. or I'm just going to like people watch and like be the creep in the nail salon that's staring at everyone. Yeah.
I think that's great. Yeah. I mean, I think like any way you can to kind of realize that you're in a cycle is really important. Like to realize that, you know, your brain encounters a hard thing it doesn't want to think about. And then compensates by becoming really busy or focusing too much on work or being on your phone constantly or whatever, to realize that you're we're all to a certain extent in cycles like that all the time. And then to like make purposeful effort to break those cycles,
deviate from it.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Because, you know, you can't say like, here's the magic solution to any of this stuff. But I think you can say if you go on a 2-hour walk and don't look at your phone the whole time, that you will have new thoughts that you didn't have before. And that that can be the start of a new kind of, you know, cycle that allows you to think about yourself and the world differently.
Yeah. Okay. I really want to talk about ketamine.
Yeah. Yeah.
And maybe we can, you know, wind down the episode with that.
Sure.
So how would you describe ketamine and then also just like the feeling of being on it? Kind of two different questions.
So ketamine's a dissociative. It's pretty unique. You know, usually things fall into like stimulant or psychedelic or, you know,
downers.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so ketamine is pretty unique in what it is. It was started as a, people always call it a horse tranquilizer, which it can be, but it's been used in humans since it was invented in like, I think the 40s or 50s.
Actually, if you get anesthesia, did you know that people who are allergic to like the typical anesthetics they use, you can request ketamine?
Yeah, yeah. So it's used all the time. And it's also used in some like terrible ways too, like to sedate people that they're arresting.
Can talk about that too.
So it's been around for, you know, many decades, and I don't know why it keeps being called a horse tranquilizer. It's like a human medication. In really high doses, it sedates people, which is why it can be used as anesthesia. But in smaller doses, it essentially scrambles your brain in some way. I read a whole book on like how ketamine works, and the answer is like, we don't really know. But part of the reason people think it might be really good for mental health is because of how many kind of different receptors it affects in your brain, unlike something like antidepressant, which is really only focusing on serotonin or dopamine. Ketamine is just like just popping a balloon or something. Like it just goes everywhere. And the other really great thing about it is that it only lasts like 15 minutes to half an hour. So even if you have a bad time on ketamine, it'll be over soon.
Yeah, it's not like taking mushrooms or acid, right, which can last like 6 hours.
Right. Yeah. It's so hard to describe, but it feels like you're almost mentally floating above yourself. Like you can see your brain thinking in a way. And I've just had so many great revelations on ketamine where, you know, it feels like something that was all the way over on the left side of my brain and something was all the way over on the right side of my brain, like can finally connect to each other and see each other. And I think that's why it's so helpful for mental health, and why a lot of drugs like hallucinogens are helpful for mental health, is because they allow you to form these new connections that in your conscious mind, you're not really able to form. So. And the other thing just to say about ketamine is that it's super safe. I mean, there's problems with drug contamination and stuff, but it's not like an opioid or something. Like people aren't really dying from taking
overdosing
ketamine.
From it. Yeah. I've never talked about this publicly, but I actually have used ketamine many, many, many times, never in a doctor's office. It's been my substance of choice when going out. Mm-hmm. I don't really like drinking. It really hurts my stomach and I don't like uppers. So ketamine has just like hit this sweet spot a few years ago when I first tried it. And yeah, my description of it is, yeah, it's this out of body experience, but it's almost like I'm tipsy, but like I want to dance and like music feels very elevated to me. And like, I almost like can feel, yeah, you're in like this dissociative trance. It just feels like I can forget the world for like the 10, 15 minutes that I have the hit. And then if I want to do a little bit more, I can. I have accidentally gone into a K-hole before, and that was not a great experience. And honestly, not a great experience for my mental health either. Like, I'm kind of can be a very paranoid person. That's why I don't smoke weed. And it made me feel pretty paranoid.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great description, what you just said. And I think it goes to like, I think there are different ways to use the same drug, right? Like you can do a high dose of ketamine on your couch and then be like, I'm going to think really deeply about my past traumas, right? Or you can go clubbing and use it to have fun. And I've done both. And I think it's equally good for both. I have gone into a K-hole and it was scary, but in a good way. I mean, we kind of started this conversation talking about global warming, and it was actually, I lived in New Orleans for a few years up until like 8 months ago or something. And it was like during Mardi Gras, and I accidentally like took like three times as much ketamine as I ever have. And I was just like, oh no, like what's going to happen? And we were like in the middle of a Mardi Gras parade, and my friend had to like lead me through the entire city, just like to safety. It was funny. But then as I was in this K-hole, I was just like, oh no, we're all going to like die. And like global warming is going to like kill us all. And everyone's like, what are you talking about? We're like in the middle of Mardi Gras. And I just like released all of this emotion that I had, like this dread about the future and this feeling that like nothing mattered because the world was so scary and all that stuff. And so it was a scary, I wouldn't say it was an enjoyable experience, but afterwards I felt like I'd kind of relieved this burden that I didn't even know I had in my mind. And it was really helpful, honestly.
Yeah, I mean, that is definitely something for whoever's listening that's like, oh, I want to try ketamine now. Like, I think start really small and and like make sure you're with people you really trust, because like you're explaining, like if you take a little bit too much, it can like kind of knock you a little loopy. And so you want to make sure you're physically safe. And I always remind people, test your drugs too.
Yep.
You want to make sure they're not cutting it with other stuff. And I actually have had some friends, specifically one I'm thinking of, who has very bad obsessive compulsive disorder. And he used to do ketamine like at the hospital and do IVs of it like under doctor's care. And they kind of like, I've never done it that way, but they like put you in a room and like a comfortable chair with like a fuzzy blanket.
Right.
Like maybe they put an eye mask on and then they hook you up to the IV and they give you like 30 minutes. And then they come in and like check on you. And it's been proven to be actually like pretty successful with not only OCD, but like depressive episodes. They're using it more and more to treat depression.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think ketamine is, it can be really useful. I think one of the problems is that it's becoming, as it becomes medicalized, it's becoming so expensive. I mean, to do ketamine treatments, you know, can cost $5,000-$6,000. Whereas like doing a dose of ketamine on your own costs like $5, right? I agree with everything you said, by the way, like don't use it alone, especially your first time. Be safe like you would with any other drug. So just putting that out there. But as I was saying before, it really helps you kind of rewire your brain. And it's something that scientists call neuroplasticity, right? That our brain can kind of get hardwired, especially when we're depressed or, you know, have something like OCD. We keep doing these loops over and over again of, if you're depressed, like, oh, like life doesn't matter, therefore I don't need to do this thing, therefore I then have
not going to get out of bed.
Right. And so that loop can kind of be broken by something like ketamine. And I think it can be broken by other drugs too, or even other experiences. But yeah, I mean, I think the most promising drugs it's seeming like are ketamine, psilocybin, shrooms, and LSD. What's kind of scary is that drug companies are now trying to create patentable versions of those drugs that don't get you high, because for some reason in this country, we have the idea that if something is fun, then it can't be good for you.
Yeah.
So they're trying to create versions of like ketamine that don't actually get you high, but still have the same antidepressant effects, which I think is really unfortunate. One, because it's fun and you should be able to have fun, and medicine should be able to be fun. But two, I think we're really misunderstanding why these drugs work. And it's not just because they do something chemical in your brain. It's because they allow you to have this spiritual out-of-body experience that allows you to see your life differently. So I think removing that component of a drug kind of defeats the purpose in a lot of ways.
I wonder though why they would do that, because I think of like opiates, for example, and like why, you know, obviously like the Sackler stuff, the reason the epidemic happened is because it does get you high. Not right. that I would call it fun per right. se, if you've ever gotten like your wisdom teeth out or something and taken a Percocet, but it's like, I'm sure they could separate the high from the numbness, but they didn't, because ultimately that's what made it addictive. So I would think with ketamine and trying to sell these drugs, they would want it to be as addictive as possible.
Interesting. I never thought about that.
I don't know. I'm just thinking out loud. That just like hit me just now.
No, I think that's a good point. I think because they know they won't, like, opiates have been around for hundreds of years, right? Like, people were being prescribed morphine like 200 years ago, right? So I think that's part of it. But that being said, I believe it's Johnson & Johnson sells ketamine.
Yes, the nasal spray.
The nasal spray.
So and I knew a woman who was in my program at McLean, and she, I don't know if I'm on, whatever, I'm not going to name her, so HIPAA should be fine. Yeah. But she used to be prescribed, yeah, and ketamine nasal spray, and then also throat lozenges. Mm-hmm. So like her doctor would say, oh, you're having a panic attack, like pop a ketamine lozenge.
Right.
But I think those are such lower dose. Obviously the IV is going to be much more intense.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is. It will be fascinating to watch over the next 10 years. I don't know. I just think of even like marijuana or like where we're heading with magic mushrooms.
Right.
Like these are going to become huge businesses. Is ketamine next? Is LSD next? Is cocaine even next?
I think ketamine and LSD and shrooms, I think they might all be next. Cocaine, I don't know about, but I do think we've now, like, the state has now realized that instead of banning these drugs, they can profit off of them.
I know, which is so fucked up, because I'm like, still, right, there's so many people sitting in prison over like fucking drug charges on off of marijuana.
Right, exactly.
And
yeah,
now there's like mostly like middle-aged white men who are now like billionaires off of weed.
Right, exactly. And I do think the same thing might happen with these other drugs, and I think that's unfortunate, but at the same time, I am glad that they're becoming less stigmatized and that people are kind of thinking of drugs differently than we used to. I think one thing that I am cautious of is that we shouldn't view drugs as like a complete solution to mental health, no matter what the drug is, whether it's an SSRI or ketamine or whatever, because I think we get caught in this trap of like thinking we found the magic bullet, like, oh, ketamine can cure depression for people that SSRIs didn't work for, therefore we've found the answer to depression. And it's like, to me, as I was saying at the beginning, I think we're always going to have depression, we're always going to struggle with mental health as long as the world is making us feel so sad. So I just don't want to get caught up in this like magical thinking of like, oh, we've found the answer now that
the cure.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Well, I take Lexapro, mm-hmm, and I am a huge proponent. Like, it has literally changed my life. But at the same time, I think it should only add to your life.
Right.
It shouldn't like be the end all be all. Like, I don't want to take this pill and like all of a sudden I wake up tomorrow and like I feel fixed. I'm
right.
Healthy. I'm not mentally ill.
Right. Exactly. I think all of these things can be like tools you use to help your mental health. I think thinking of anything as a solution, I think, is the wrong way to think of things.
I do. So for someone who's listening that like maybe doesn't really agree with our conversation, mm-hmm, and they think like, oh, ketamine or any of these drugs is really just a form of escapism. Like, mm-hmm, isn't it actually just forgetting your problems? It's not dealing with them. What would you say to that?
I mean, I think it depends how these drugs are used. You can use anything as escapism. I mean, watching TV for 5 hours after you get home from work is escapism.
Yeah,
Escapism isn't bad. I think so. Even if they are being used for escapism, I don't think that's a bad thing. But that being said, I think it's about the intentionality you go into these things with, right? If you are going for a run wearing headphones and not letting yourself think at all, then are you using the run for escapism? Versus if you go on a run and you allow yourself to process all the emotions you weren't allowing yourself to feel that day, then, you know, the run becomes a tool for emotional growth, right? And I think the same thing is true with ketamine or any other drug too. It's, are you using it to numb yourself, or are you doing it in a way that is allowing yourself to deal with what you're scared to deal with?
Yeah. And like, also maybe it's giving you the break from like our harsh reality.
Yeah.
Like a break from the world that we live in, which like we should be allowed to have that break.
Exactly. When I was writing this big story on ketamine, someone said, we live in such an algorithmically determined world now, you know, with social media and everything, and ketamine scrambles the code, right? So instead of all of our thoughts and tastes and everything coming to us so in such a regimented way, we just have something that kind of like scrambles it. And I think that's why it's so popular right now, is because we do live in this world where everything is kind of expected of us that, you know, when we play one song on Spotify, Spotify knows the next 10 songs we want to listen to. Our tastes are dictated by all of these huge corporations and everything. And I think ketamine just kind of like makes your brain kind of reset, right? And I think that is really valuable. And if that's a form of escapism, so be it. But I think it's a valuable form of escapism.
Yeah. Wow. I feel like we covered so much. And this is a different conversation than some of the other ones I've had, which is what I'm like trying to do with the show. So let me ask, where can my listeners find you?
So my newsletter is Mental Health, spelled mental, H-E-L-L-T-H, .xyz, mentalhealth.xyz. And my Twitter is my initials twice, so underscore pempem. And yeah, if you just Google me, I'm around.